Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And this is the Wednesday review, as I've now decided to christen it. And today I want to talk a little bit about Gotham Rising by Jules Stewart. It's a book about New York in the 1930s. And it comes from IB Tourist, my regular supply of free and interesting books. It's a cultural history, really, and I like it because it's a snapshot of a particularly exciting and dynamic era. In the front cover has this kind of panorama of New York at that moment, and the buildings long before the great sort of towers of glass emerged from the 60s onwards are this kind of snapshot of the images and hopes and aspirations, really, of modernism itself. And the New York emerges in the first quarter of the 20th century as this landmark of modernity. It is the epicenter of the skyscraper, the home of jazz, and an icon of American confidence, even during the Great Depression, which is really when most of this book is set. And I think there's an immense value in looking at books like this from time to time, because they are evocative of this idea of place. This idea that at certain times, certain places have particular historical and culturally defined meanings. That it's hard really to identify, sometimes hard even on a conscious level to identify, and hard to untangle. And this book helps to navigate that. The book paints a very vivid picture of social life in New York at the start of the 1930s. And here's an extract. Imagine taking a stroll up Midtown Manhattan on a summer evening in 1931. Swankily attired women are to be admired along the street in long skirts and backless evening frocks. This is a time when hemlines have dropped with a bang to supplant the bare-legged flapper style of the Roaring Twenties. Most certainly, some of the ladies are out to show off the daring new fad for leisure wear, lampooned in the New York Times fashion pages as formal pyjamas for streetwear. A few women might be strolling along on their own, proudly taking advantage of America's new age of gender equality. After all, It's now just a moment, more than a decade, since they earned the right to vote. But more than likely, they're accompanied by debonair young men in loose-fitting jackets and striped summer blazers and billowing Oxford bags. There's no disguising the craze to emulate the dapper and elegant Duke and Duchess of Windsor, those two fashion icons of the 1930s who bestow their glamour on the salons of the newly appointed Waldorf Astoria Hotel, the Stork Club, and other gathering spots of the Manhattan Smart Set. With 2 years to go before the repeal of Prohibition, many of these couples are no doubt heading to one of the New York speakeasies, which number in the thousands. The classiest of these clandestine gin palaces is the 21 Club in 52nd Street, whose cellar is cleverly concealed in a bar well stocked with imported wines and spirits. The 21 Club counts among its distinguished clientele the cream of New York society, including its flamboyant mayor, Gentleman Jimmy Walker. The most classily turned out men are identifiable by their broad-shouldered, double-breasted suits and wide-brimmed soft felt hats. These are the bootleggers, most of them Italian mobsters who keep the speakeasies supplied with booze, smuggled in from Canada and Europe. This is the time of widespread mafia violence when it's not uncommon to find bullet-ridden bodies in the streets in the wake of gangland feuding between whiskey barons. The more adventurous Manhattanites setting out for a night on the town are travelling to 125th Street in the heart of Harlem to listen to Duke Ellington at the Cotton Club, where the Jazz Legends Orchestra plays as the house band. Others head for Broadway's famed Great White Way to take in one of the popular music halls of the day. Topping the reviews are George and Ira Gershwin's Of the Icing and Cole Porter's The New Yorkers, the latter a prohibition satire that takes no prisoners, be they socialites or bootleggers. Only a few months earlier, in April, the Empire State Building was completed, eclipsing its rival the Chrysler Building as the world's tallest skyscraper. Both these Art Deco masterpieces light up Manhattan's night sky with almost mystical radiance that is visible from Central Park to the north and all the way to the Bowery, 2 miles south. Now imagine that for whatever reason, perhaps out of simple curiosity to explore another corner of the city, you execute a volte-face and direct your feet to the murky side of the street. You pass Union Square, bounded north and south by 17th and 14th Streets, east and west by Park Avenue South and Union Square West. A great tumult has erupted from the north corner, where speakers are harangued and the crowd speakers are haranguing the crowd from makeshift soapboxes. Without warning, baton-swinging mounted police have lost patience with the Communist Party of the USA rally that has blocked traffic with its noisy call to join the class struggle and overthrow the capitalist system. You pick up the pace, heading down to the darkened recesses of the Bowery. Here you are greeted by an entirely different spectacle of thousands of homeless and hungry, clustering in the streets with nowhere to spend the night and with no idea where their next meal is coming from. Unshaven men of all ages, their eyes blank, indifferent to the clatter of the Third Avenue elevated subway rumbling overhead. The streets are lined with the derelict tenements and boarded-up shops whose doorways shelter the destitute from the elements. Knots of men crowd together around makeshift bonfires. When the winter comes, they will hold their caps over the flames just long enough to absorb the heat and replace them on their heads. They will perform this ritual hour after hour. So obviously the big story that contextualises this entire book is the Great Depression. The Great Depression lasts for much longer in America than it does in Europe. By 1934, Great Britain is rising out of the Depression, but the America stays in far longer. This is put down to the fact that America does not abandon its fixed system of exchange, the gold standard, until much later. It's only the war that seems to really power America out of the financial doldrums. However, you get a real division in New York, as a third of New Yorkers live in poverty. But there is a record pace of skyscraper building. Central districts of Manhattan, Times Square and places like that are still alive with advertising hoardings and neon lights proclaiming the glories of American consumerism. And the irony, of course, is that the first kind of pebbles of the landslide fall in New York itself on Wall Street. Now, previously, I've talked about the Wall Street crash at length, and the only thing that kind of bears repeating here is the psychology and the thinking and the beliefs that underpinned the Wall Street crash, in that the shift of the American economy towards financialization, towards a speculative economy and an economy based on borrowing, really are the seeds of its downfall. And the belief that a financialized economy based on speculative value as opposed to real values or real asset values, values of stuff, you know, shops, factories, and infrastructure producing wealth, that could continually, the speculative wealth that could continually lay golden eggs, as it were, this was unconditionally accepted that this was the case. And it's tempting to suggest that this fantasy is produced by a deeper belief in American exceptionalism, one which was intimately tied in with isolationist tendencies after the First World War. Not that America actually becomes as isolationist as people think. It's still making all sorts of bilateral agreements, just doesn't join the League of Nations. But there is a deeply isolationist aspect to American culture. And it manifests itself in the economic thinking of the late 1920s in a belief that the normal workings of the economy don't really apply to the United States. For example, Dr. Max Winkler, a lecturer in international finance at the School of Business of the College of the City of New York, said, "The United States may reasonably be said to be immune from economic and social disturbance. Doom criers and Cassandras at the end of the 1920s did not fit with the kind of national experience of the 1920s, particularly in cosmopolitan outposts like New York, where the 1920s had been experienced as a period of mass consumerism. And it was a time which held out the promise to those who didn't participate in the mass consumerism that lifestyle was just around the corner. The realities of a decade of economic crisis were really too unpalatable to consider, even though as we draw later into 1929, more and more voices are starting to suggest that unrestrained speculation was going to blow the economy wide open. The problem, of course, is that America in the 1920s had experienced such an explosive level of economic growth in terms of manufacturing and mass production that markets had quite literally become saturated, especially when consumer markets had become burdened by debt. There was basically too much stuff. In the years between 1918 and 1929, US manufacturing output doubled, a feat that has not been repeated in US economic history since. The American automobile industry in the 3 years up to 1929 put 1 million extra cars on the road, and 80% of the cars in the entire world were owned by the affluent American middle class. The crash that happened at the end of October in 1929 in New York was followed by the mayoral election, in which Mayor Walker, who was widely seen as a corrupt and dissolute drunkard, who was deeply associated with corrupt Tammany Hall politics and the Mafia, managed to retain his tenure, and served until 1932. The shortcomings of Walker were well known, but it was widely seen as a safe pair of hands in a crisis. His various exploits that were publicised, his drinking and notorious philandering, were overlooked, and Walker, a Democrat and the son of Irish-American immigrants, easily defeated Fiorello LaGuardia, a Republican from Greenwich Village. The corrupt Tammany Hall system, the fact that New York had two Democrat voters to every Republican, and the fact that the New York City Press, particularly led by William Randolph Hearst, were more than happy to support Walker against LaGuardia, ensured that Walker was going to be returned as mayor. Franklin Roosevelt, who was the governor of New York from 1928 to 1933, was very wary of the Tammany Hall system, even though he too was a Democrat, and he treated it with respect and mistrust. Despite the crushing defeat for LaGuardia, who was unable to carry a single assembly district, and only took 26% of the vote, which was the lowest figure for any mayor or candidate since the creation of Greater New York in 1898, he actually returned in 1934 to become mayor and served three successive terms and had an airport named after him. Finally, the New York establishment turned on Walker. It is an affair with a chorus girl, and his all expenses paid trips to Europe, his debaucheries at drinking holes, particularly the aforementioned 21 Club, shifted the tide of public opinion, particularly in a time of straitened circumstances and sobriety of the mid-1930s. Admittedly, by this time, prohibition had been ended, but the general view of public officials was that it was this kind of behaviour in the 1920s that had got everyone into a mess, indeed. Anyway, that's just a taste of the book, which you can get from Ivy Tours and or all good bookshops. It's well worth a read, and it's really, I think the quality of the book comes from the colour it gives, the kind of the very rich tapestry of New York at its peak. You see characters as diverse as Winston Churchill, Bugs Moran, the gangster, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the guy who built the Empire State Building, John J. Raskob, interacting in this exciting and dynamic moment in cultural history. I think the only other point in New York history which kind of rivals the 1930s is the 1970s, when the city was on the verge of bankruptcy, and yet you have explosions of music from punk to hip-hop to disco emerging in Manhattan and beyond. Okay, well, I'll finish there. But yes, get yourself a copy of Gotham Rising. It's a great read. And remember, please, when you can, support your independent book retailers. Try to buy from wherever you can from ethical booksellers online, or go straight to the publisher, IB Tours. If we don't do these things, then the system for creating these books will wither, and we'll all be the poorer. Anyway, catch you again on Friday with the final podcast of the week. I hope you guys are having a good one. I'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.